All right, folks, welcome to the Monsters, Madness, and Magic Podcast. I'm your host, Justin, here with a quick word before we dive in. Now, in this episode, I chat with author Keith Taylor about the origins of Felimid MacFall, Conan, continuing the legacy of Robert Howard's horror stories, Irish mythology, historical fiction, and more. As always, thank you all for listening out there, and without further ado, here you go.
Greetings, boils and ghouls. This is your comrade, the Crypt Keeper here, reporting dead from the Sanctuary of the Strange. Tonight's macabre myth is a fright-filled feature, one overflowing with monsters, madness, and magic.
Mr. Taylor, take us back in time. You're a youngster. Were you a book reader, fort builder, troublemaker, or all of the above?
I was the avid reader. anything I could get hold of, I would read, including the little captions on the back of bus tickets. Funny, it seems like, to me, it seems like a whole different world now. No personal computers, no word processors. People still use typewriters and correction fluid. Carbon paper, unbelievable. It's prehistoric.
It's a different age.
Yeah. Comic books, of course. There was some Australian illustrators did a comic version of Alfred Bester's The Star's My Destination. And I only got a few episodes of that, but there was a comic called Silver Star, which was like an Australian version of Flash Gordon. Only instead of going to another planet, they went to the hidden world inside the Earth.
Wow.
The old Pellucidar idea.
Some Jules Verne inspired
yes.
stuff.
Yeah. I would read anything science fiction, kids' science fiction. There was a lot of that around. Everything from The Phantom to, there weren't any Conan comics then, or I would have read them right away. But yeah.
What was your first experience with Conan?
Oh, yeah. That was when I was 14, and I remember it really well because I was browsing in a secondhand bookstore. I was 14, and I found this. It was half of an Ace Double novel, The Sword of Rhiannon by Lee Brackett, which I bought that. And then I noticed it had been stolen from the local library and sold to the secondhand bookshop. And on the inside front page, it said the other half is Conan the Conqueror by Robert E. Howard. So I went off to the library, and sure enough, they had the other half there. So Conan the Conqueror was my first introduction to Conan, and they had a couple of other books, the old Gnome Press ones, The Sword of Conan and The Coming of Conan. I grabbed those, and I was hooked on Robert E. Howard from then on in the 60s. Well, of course, all the Lancer books and Ace books of Conan started getting published, and King Cole. And then came the big boom in the 70s, Howard boom. I tried my hand at, because I'd been writing since I was 9, I would just get hold of, every year I had to get together all the garbage I'd written, the kid stuff. And by the end of the year, I would have stacks of it. And I would take them down to the backyard and burn them at the bottom of the garden.
Oh, no.
And then next year I'd start over again, and I just practiced and practiced and practiced until I finally started to get better.
Get better you did. So you have this early fascination with Robert Howard. When did you venture beyond the sword and sorcery of Robert Howard into more the Lovecraft side of things?
Oh, I didn't see those early on. After Conan, the next ones I read of his were the Solomon Cain stories, because they were printed in thin little paperback. I was fascinated by Solomon Cain as well.
That's my personal favorite Robert Howard protagonist.
Yeah. I really like him. He's sort of like this mysterious figure out of the shadows. He's like a 16th century version of the Shadow. He's the guy who suddenly shows up, and Howard, Oh, Howard did him so well. Like when he finds that village burn and this young girl violated and dying, and she dies, and he stands up and he doesn't say anything at all except men shall die for this.
I love
And does he
it.
mean it? Even though I got really influenced by Howard, I've always felt a bit bashful about copying any writing stories about heroes that he had actually written stories about. The Thing on the Roof, for example, is a little bit different because it's a short story, it's in the public domain, and it's good enough to, it seems legitimate to expand on it a bit because I always wondered what happened to that guy after the Tushman was stamped flat by a huge hoof in his own house. And he was not, he was in the house that night. He was known to be on bad terms with Tushman. He would have had a few questions to answer to the police.
And
And
that's where you're going to expand on it.
he gets cleared in a coroner's court in the first couple of chapters, but it turns out his problems are only beginning.
So, sticking with your childhood a bit, Keith, was there anyone else in your family that was creatively inclined? Do you think that's where your roots came from?
Well, my mother loved writing, and she did some writing after she left school, but she never got anywhere with it. And actually, my dad, he was in the army, and he was on the he worked on trams and buses, I think, and he was looking for something more, something different. So he took a number of courses. One of them was a writing course, and I still remember his stories. I thought they were pretty good, but but nothing ever came of it for him.
What about, when you think back to films that you grew up on, what pops into your mind?
Oh, the sword and sandal epics and those Hollywood Arabian Nights type things like Son of Sinbad. And the general consensus seems to be that Son of Sinbad, which had Vincent Price in it as the hero's offsider, was pretty terrible. But I thought it was good, and well, I liked it anyway. I liked the way that the Sinbad, who was just who was your typical muscle-bound hero, who fought with his sword arm, but his offsider was the intelligent one, and he ended up with the intelligent girl, while the son of Sinbad ended up with a harem of beautiful but not so very bright girls, who would have suited him better, I think. Yeah, there was always the banquet scene with the dancing girls. You couldn't have a Hollywood Arabian Nights movie without him.
Right.
Not that I was complaining.
That'll keep all the young men interested.
Yeah.
So, what records were spinning around the house when you were growing up? Big music fan growing up?
Yeah. Actually, I didn't become a real music fan until I was in the army. I joined the army at 18, got out at 24. I had one tour in Vietnam. But I was in the medical corps, not the infantry, so I didn't really see any action. My military career was undistinguished. But while I was in the army, I joined a record club, and I used quite a bit of my army money to buy records and pack them around with me when I moved from one base to another. And any time I got on leave, I would go home and leave them at home. But oh yeah, it was the when I was in the army, it was the 60s, the big protest movement. I got a lot of the protest songs that, and Joan Baez and the Australians. They weren't so much into protest, but the Seekers, some classic and light musical shows.
Did you ever pick up an instrument?
No. I'm and I don't have much of an ear for notes, or my son's a lot more musical than me. He,
Really?
he plays an instrument, and he uses electronic keyboards. He's
Ooh.
good, actually. I think he's good, and he composes music for sort of soundtracks. He's even written a couple of novels, and I think maybe I'm biased, but I think they're great. I think he's better than I was at his age.
Wow, how old is he?
He's about 35 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wanted to ask you specifically if you were into music, considering Fellowman's profession.
No, afraid not. No, and I got off on a tangent. Yeah, no, no, I don't. No, I don't compose or music or play an instrument. I'm not talented that way.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that you began experimenting writing when you were 9.
Yes.
When did you publish your first story?
Oh, that wasn't until quite a bit later. Let's see. Yeah. I got my first story published in the 70s. I was just 30, and it was in Fantastic Stories with Ted White. That was the first Fellowman story, actually,
Wow.
Fugitives in Winter. And it was funny how things came together after that, because that was the same year, 75, that there was the 33rd World Science Fiction Convention was held in Melbourne, which is where I was at the time. And of course, I went along, and at a room party, someone told me that if, now that I had a story accepted for Fantastic, Ted White was the editor then, I was eligible to join Science Fiction Writers of America. So I wrote, applying, and the treasurer at the time was Andrew J. Offutt, and he was working on a novel based on the adventures of Cormac. Sorry, excuse me.
You're fine.
Based on the continuing the adventures of Cormac MacArthur, the 5th-century Gaelic pirate, and Robert E. Howard's character, and mine, Fellowman, was set in the same period, a little bit later. That's all, and we got to writing, and we ended up working together on a couple of Cormac MacArthur novels, collaborating. I sort of supplied the historical background because I'd done all the research for Fellowman. We ended up publishing two novels, When Deathbirds Fly and The Tower of Death. That was The Tower of Death was Lovecraftian too. They go to northwestern Spain, and there's this huge lighthouse based on the Pharos of Alexandria that the Romans built, really existed, the Tower of Hercules. But I had it become haunted by a nest of Lovecraftian deep ones. The local king wanted to establish a navy, and he wanted Cormac and Wulfhere's help, the Danish pirate that Cormac's offsider is. But first, he's got to get rid of these monsters.
Yeah, that's something I love about your writing, Keith, just personally, is steeped in history. You can tell that you've done your homework.
Yeah, I was always fascinated by history. I don't know why, but I was. I noticed Robert E. Howard. He had a even when he couldn't do the research as well as he would have liked, he had a real feeling for history, and he could make it feel real.
Yeah.
The Shadow of the Vulture is it's great. I think it's one of his best. Of course, that's the one that had Red Sonja appear for the first time.
Right. And just sticking on your writing, I know each project is different, but generally speaking, are you a heavy outliner? Do you like to go with the flow and fix it later? What's your writing process look like?
Well, I do an outline first, and I try to make it detailed, but I don't stick to it. I don't stick to it fanatically. I often veer off and say, "Nah, I won't have it going that way. I'll have it going this way." Sort of, yeah.
The character of Fellamid, what is the seeds of inspiration for him, I guess? Do you remember when you first started to kind of tinker around with him?
Yeah. Oh, there was that would have been in my teens, yeah. And well, the seeds were quite a few different legendary poets and harpers. There was Thomas the Rhymer, who was Scottish. I always liked the part in a traditional ballad where the fairy queen offers him the gift of the tongue that can never lie, and he says, "Are you kidding me? I'd never dare talk to a pretty girl or approach a lord or noble." If I had to always tell the truth,
Right.
he was one thing. And then there was Paul Anderson's Capybara. He was a traveling minstrel. He was from the south and a civilized guy, and had made the mistake of going up north among the Vikings to see if he could make some money with them. But they didn't have any taste for his sophisticated roundels and ballads and poetry. So in the end, he decided he'd get out. Especially after he and go back to the south, especially after he had a run-in with a troll who nearly ate him. It's good because he's not quite the heroic guy you usually find in heroic fantasy. He's not afraid of the troll, and because he's not afraid, the troll can't touch him. But the reason he's not afraid is he believes he's got magical protection. Turns out he didn't. He practically freaks out. What? You mean she could have torn me apart any time? Then there was in one of Robert E. Howard's Cormac McCarthy stories, there was a character, a British minstrel, Donald of the Harp, and he, I got some from him too, and from Howard's Mad Minstrel Rinaldo in the that was in the first Conan story ever published, the Phoenix on the Sword. And Rinaldo was one of the fanatical conspirators who wanted to kill that black-hearted barbarian who took over the kingdom. Conan didn't want to kill him because he thought he's a poet, he's a harper, he's beyond my reach. But
Exactly.
he had to kill him in the end, and because Rinaldo had just stabbed him and was going to stab him again. Okay, you can respect a poet only so far. Yeah.
With the Felimid, with the rhymes that appear throughout the Bard series. Now, I know you said you weren't musical, but in your head when you're writing, did you have any sort of tune they went to, like at least in your head while you were writing them?
Sometimes, and I looking for inspiration too. I used to listen to a lot of Celtic harp music. Alan Stavell was really good. He pub that was one of the records I got while I was in the army. Renaissance of the Celtic Harp, and I would listen to that a lot while I was writing the Felimid stories.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could see
Yeah.
that helping a lot. Just sticking with Felimid, like we're talking, typically speaking in sword and sorcery, you're dealing with a protagonist who is a, a swordsman, a warrior, barbarian type. Was it
Yeah.
what was it about the going a different route that spoke to you? Is it just did you enjoy that type of character?
Yes. I mean, I really enjoyed Robert E. Howard's barbarians and characters because he really put himself into them. You could feel the passion and the conviction behind each character, even. But sword swinging barbarians aren't. I like them a bit. At least a little bit more civilized. Like Felimid is from a, essentially, he's from a barbaric country on the edge of the world. But so far as they have, so far as they have cultured creative types, he's one of them. He belongs to that particular caste of poets who were privileged in Ireland. And of course, when I had him leaving Ireland and going to Britain, especially among the Anglo-Saxons, he was a bit shocked to find that they didn't respect bards as much as they did back in Ireland. Especially when he found himself hung by the heels over a wolf pit.
I just reread that story. You could
Yeah.
technically call the first Bard story a werewolf story.
Yes,
Yeah,
that's right.
and it
Yeah.
sneaks up on you. It's
Yeah.
not
That was one
really.
of the Caine stories I like best, the werewolf story,
Yeah.
Reflections for the Mirror of My Soul. It was sort of like a mystery, really. So who is the werewolf? Someone in the castle is.
It's
But even
all.
Caine finds it hard to figure out.
Yeah, but that's also, I was going to say, that's one of my favorite Caine stories is the,
Yeah,
I
mine
can't,
too.
the where, what is it called? It's in Death Angel's Bane.
Reflections for the Winter of My Soul, I think it
Yes,
is. Yeah.
that is. Love that story.
Yeah. And the werewolf turns out to be the spoiler, the minstrel.
So you're a werewolf fan, I take
Yes.
Me too. Love them.
In a way, yeah. And I really like Paul Anderson's Operation Chaos, where the main character was a werewolf in an alternate world.
I've not read that one.
But he's a but he belongs to a world where they've learned how to control these kinds of changes and make werewolves and other shape changes socially acceptable.
Wow.
He served in the army instead of preying on his fellow humans.
I'm going to check that out. I'll devour any werewolf
Operation
story.
Chaos, I thought was really good.
Okay, I'm gonna look into getting myself a copy of that. So you mentioned you've always been interested in history. Could you
Yes.
pinpoint where you became interested in Irish mythology that sort of led to Felimin?
I think that would definitely have been with Robert E. Howard.
Okay, yeah, okay.
He was I mean, I read Conan the Conqueror when I was 14, and that I got out of the Irish mythology, and from that, I loved Spears of Clontarf too. That was I loved the ones with the Irish background, Tullow O'Brien and those ones. But yeah, actual Irish history really it really fascinated me the more I got into it. The not just the history, but the myths and legends, and the continentalist trouble they had with the English.
And the Druids have always been sort of these
The
mysterious
Druids,
figures.
yeah.
Yeah, very easy to get into that.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting how they were not just magicians and seers, but they were also the lawyers of the time. They were the ones who had memorized all the traditional Irish laws, which took a lot of doing.
Was there always plans for the Bard series after the release of Bard One, or were they written? Were you sort of commissioned to continue the series?
I did it because I really wanted to. I wanted to continue his adventures. I was really happy when Ace published the first five Bard stories. They were closely connected, so it wasn't too hard to put them together as a novel. It was very easy, actually. And then I just had to continue, and I had him meeting the Danish pirate, Gudrun Blackhair, female pirate, because I'd well, by then I'd read again, besides Robert E. Howard, Poul Anderson was a big influence on me, and his Hrolf Kraki's saga, the retelling of the old Danish legends, had been published by then, and I read them, the early part of that saga. It was right on the same years, the same timeline as Thelamet and Gudrun. So I had them crossing the path of those two Danish kings and rescuing one of them from the temple where he was about to be sacrificed. And again, that temple really existed. That was a Slavic temple on the island of Rügen in the Baltic. And they did have a sacred white horse there, and they were supposed to have weird powers, the priests in that temple. So it was like ready-made. I got it out of Encyclopedia of Mythology, the Slavic mythology. I like setting them in a real history because it sort of seems to give it a sort of solid grounding. And then you can really get down on all the supernatural stuff. And it makes it seem more real somehow.
It does. I completely agree. Just curious, Keith, you published some early stories under a pen name, Dennis Moore. What was your reason behind the pen name?
Well, it was because I felt shy and awkward, and I didn't think they were good enough to publish, and I wanted to hide behind a false name. But I only did that a couple of times. Then I got more confidence, started publishing under my own name, Keith Taylor.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
Is imposter syndrome something that you struggled with early on, or perhaps even still struggle with it?
Yes, I did a bit. Yeah, and when I well, I was having health problems. I got lymphoma due to exposure to chemicals in Vietnam, and that was pretty bad, actually. I dropped down to 8 stone, but they gave me chemo, and I responded pretty well. But I wasn't writing for a while, and then I did start writing again. But I started to get frustrated because I'd written novel after novel, and none of them had found a market. So there was a big gap. But the great thing is that just now I seem to have I seem to have hit my stride again because Bard 6 is going to be published sometime this year, I believe, as an e-book, and also the sequel to the one inspired by Howard's The Thing on the Roof. With luck, that'll be published this year, and I've also got a contract for the sequel, so that's three novels that are going to be coming out soon.
That's great news.
I'm over the moon about that, and I really want to get a lot more things published. So I'm working like crazy on it. When I finish the sequel to the Thing on the Roof novel, that'll be two. I want to try something different as well. I want to try some historical novels set in Galway in the late 18th century, with a lawyer for the detective, and also he's a defender of the native Irish against the English judges. Anytime he can get an Irishman off in an English judge's court, it makes his day.
I'm interested. You've been writing Felimid for 40 plus years. Have you noticed
Yes.
now that you write Bard Six at your current age, has the character changed at all as the man has aged?
Oh, no, I don't think all that much because he has changed a bit in that he's like more responsible and he's back in his own milieu again, his own culture. He's come back from his wanderings, and so he has reservations about the new religion, the Christian religion. But unlike some people, he knows new things are here and they're not going to go away. Some Christian abbots and bishops he gets along with, and some he doesn't. His closest friend among the monks is Saint Brandon the Voyager. Besides being a monk and founder of monasteries, he was a famous seafarer. And he's more reasonable than some, so Felimid gets along with him. He doesn't get along with the Abbot of Armagh, who's the successor of St. Patrick. He finds him too fanatical and harsh.
Speaking of Felimid, I have this here.
Oh,
This
yeah.
with featuring a new bard story that came out not long ago. What can you tell me about
Yes, a couple of years ago.
Night of the Burning Ghosts? Have you had that one around for a while? Did you just write it fresh?
No, I wrote it for that anthology,
Mm.
actually. Yeah. And, it's that is one of those things where Felimid's mother is the actually the abbess of a religious group on an island. It was one of the monasteries where which had a fairly flexible rule. Monks and nuns were allowed to marry, which was the case with some of the Celtic monasteries, and with others not the case. Some were really fanatical and ascetic, and some weren't, and they were. They were pretty much free to make their own rules in the Celtic Church, which, of course, the Pope didn't like.
Course not.
The worst of it came to the worst when Henry II was King of England, and he conned the Pope into giving him the right to invade Ireland and conquer it, as long as everybody was forced to adhere to the Roman rule and pay the See of Peter a silver penny a year for the privilege of being conquered.
I like to let me just back up a second, Keith. I forgot to ask you this question earlier. I like to ask everyone, what scared you as a kid?
What scared me as a kid?
Yeah.
As a little kid, I was terrified of owls, even though there were none around. One night, it wasn't an owl, it was a cat, came and sat on the windowsill outside, and I saw its glowing yellow eyes. I thought it was an owl, and I screamed the place down.
Why do you
I don't know
what?
why I was so scared of
Oh,
owls. I'd
okay.
never seen an owl.
There's a sort of a folklore around owls that they're always connected with extraterrestrials. That if you see an owl, there's a possibility you could see a UFO or something along those lines. That they're sort of
Whoa.
harbingers.
I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, I knew owls are harbingers, yeah. But so people are connecting them with UFOs and extraterrestrials too.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Hey, that's an owl right behind you.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I have it.
Good thing I'm over being scared of them by now. Yeah.
Now, correct. Please correct me if I'm saying this wrong, because I'm not sure of the pronunciation. But I wanted to ask you about the Danann series.
Well, I don't know how to pronounce it in the actual Celtic. It's spelt Tuatha De Danann, but it's pronounced, I think, Toha De Dovan. But I pronounce it Danann since it's set back in a mythical time of about the Bronze Age, about 1700 BC, is how I'm imagining it. But
Okay.
yeah, no, and they were. I wanted to do something about a bit different. And these were Felimid's ancestors, remote ancestors, the magical race who inhabited Ireland before the Celts came. Yeah, so I wanted to do some of and base it on some of the ancient Danann myths. Like his ancestors were Cabri the Harper and Ogmul the war champion. In the legends, they were father and son, but I made him. Twin brothers instead.
Oh, okay.
Suited my purpose better. So I changed it around. No
See,
scruples.
I have that series on order. It has not arrived at my house yet, but I have it on order because I wanted to read it. I was not familiar with it.
In paper, they've been out of print for quite a while, I think, but they have been published by Speaking Volumes in as an electronic book, electronic books.
I'm a physical. I have to. I'm a collector. I'm a big
I know. Yeah.
nerd. I have
Me
to have.
too. I feel that way. I feel that way myself.
I feel like I don't have it
There's
if I can't hold it.
something about a book with paper pages that does it for me the way a electronic book doesn't.
I can't get with it. This is sort of in that same vein, you know, in the age of technology. I write a little bit myself, and I've been trying to force myself to do my rough drafts and stuff on the computer because
Yeah.
it's but I can't. I are you the
No.
same way? You have to use pen and paper?
Yes. I'm still into it. I still do my rough drafts in old-fashioned exercise books. That's the yeah.
But I find that, you know, when you write your rough drafts on pen and paper, when you have to then transcribe it onto the computer, it's almost like a first edit.
Yes,
When yes,
that's exactly
so
what it is.
that helps me a
That's
lot.
how I feel too. Yeah. I thought it was just me because I come from a prehistoric time.
No, I'm very old school with my
Yeah,
approach.
I was. I was born at the end of 1946. I was one of the baby boom after the Second World War. Yeah, my dad came back from the war. He'd served in New Guinea and North Africa, and he met my mother. And of course, the war was over. Everybody was on cloud nine then, and it wasn't long before Mum went home and said to her sister, "I think I found the man I'm going to marry."
Do you keep your original paper drafts? Like, do you have filaments sitting around or anything like that?
No, I don't. Although I keep the I left them somewhere, but because I made several moves, but I keep the first drafts now. At first, I had a lot of resistance to even getting a word processor when they first came in. Typewriters, just yeah. But in the end, I gave up on typewriters and I started using word processors. But I still had to write it on paper first.
There's too much distractions on the computer for me to write. You know, there's a message
I know
popping up
exactly what you
here,
mean
and
there. Yes. Yeah.
I feel like
I start writing on the computer and then suddenly I'm on YouTube and I'm going, how did that happen?
or I edit too much while I'm writing and not edit because you know the red squiggly line appears under something and I go back and I fix it and I'm like
Yeah.
I should just be writing and fixing it later.
Yeah. You're having an interview with Michael Moorcock soon?
I've actually already interviewed him in the sub. I've interviewed him three times. They're
Yeah.
already so.
I know you interviewed him, but you're going to interview him in the near future again?
Sure, yeah, I would definitely will. I've had him on three times. It'll probably be in a few months. I try to have him on every few months because you know you just like talking
Yeah.
to him.
Do you know if he's working on any new novels or
Yep, he is working on he just finished an Elric story that just recently got published, and he's working on the wrapping up of the Eternal Champion saga.
Yeah.
He's said he's tying it all together, but he wouldn't reveal too much.
Yeah, I felt passionate about finishing up the what happened to Fomit after he returned to Ireland, and I really wanted to do that, and I felt strongly about it, but I didn't want to go on doing an endless series. I wanted to try new things. That's why a while ago I did those stories about the Egyptian priest sorcerer. Commercially, they were published in
Weird Tales.
Weird Tales at first, yeah, and then they got collected in a book by Grey Rabbit Press. And I did a that was one of the ones that frustrated me. I did a full length novel as a sequel, but it didn't find a publisher. That was one of the ones that did not find a publisher, and I started thinking, maybe I've had it, maybe I'm past it.
Did you say his name? How you pronounce it, Camose?
Kamosi, yeah, Kamosi. Yeah.
For folks that may not be familiar with that character, give us a breakdown of him.
Oh, yeah. Well, he lives in Egypt back around 1300 BC, and he's based on a genuine Egyptian legend about a man who a young priest who made the mistake of stealing the 42 scrolls of Thoth, which had all the secrets of magic in them, and He read them, and he did gain great magical powers, but he also incurred the vengeance of Thoth, the god of magic. He lost his wife and kids because of it. He's Thoth's bitter enemy, but because he needs protection, he serves another god, Anubis, the god of funeral rites and embalming. He's become the archpriest of Anubis, and he's the temple of Thoth are the priests of Thoth are his archenemies. He has sort of traveled widely, but he, even with all his magical powers and knowledge, he's come to the conclusion that there's no place like Egypt, and everywhere else is barbaric. So he does a number of things. The first one, Daggers and a Serpent, had him taking revenge on a bunch of bandits who had sacked the Temple of Anubis. Because he's the Anubis is the god of tombs and guards the sacred rest of the dead, it is not a good idea to rob tombs while Kamosi is archpriest.
I can
He,
imagine.
he, yeah.
Who was the editor of Weird Tales when you had those published?
Oh, I've forgotten. It was well, it was at least 20 years ago now. I've forgotten.
I don't think it's the same as the current editor. I think the current editor is Jonathan Mayberry.
Yeah. No, it isn't a, wait a minute, I've got those old weird tales right here.
Oh, sure,
I
go
can
ahead.
read them. If you just let me go away for a second.
Sure. While you're looking, I'll try to Google it and see if it pops up.
No, sorry, I can't find it.
Let's
I've
see.
forgotten who the editor was back then. But no, it was a different editor, that's for sure.
Was it Edwin Bard?
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay, cool. That's what Google's telling me.
And that was back in the
It may be Bayard. I may be pronouncing that wrong.
That was back in the 1990s.
It must have been, you were obviously a fan of Lovecraft and Howard. It must have been pretty cool to be
Yes.
published in Weird Tales.
Oh, it was great. I was really happy about that. Yeah, I had the first Kamosi stories. In fact, most of the Kamosi stories were published in Weird Tales, although I wrote a couple of new ones for when it was all gathered together in one volume. I really like Kamosi, as I say, for one thing, because he was such a change from Thelamid. He was a much darker character. I got some inspiration for him from Clark Ashton Smith's sorcerers in his stories. I'm a big fan of Clark Ashton Smith too.
Me too. Did you ever have any contact with Carl Wagner while he was alive? Did you guys write or anything?
No, I never did. I avidly read his stories about Cain, and I think he wrote one Conan novel too. I read that and I liked it. I often had reservations about the Conan pastiches, but thought Elspray de Camp. I love de Camp's own stuff when he's writing in his own voice, but he seemed well. He was a bit too rational to r write about a headlong, passionate, violent guy like Conan.
I don't know many folks that are fans of the L. Sprague de Camp Conans.
No, it just somehow it just doesn't seem to work. He hasn't got the. I mean, look, I would never try to write a Conan story myself because I found out when I was doing the Cormac McGarth stories, only Robert E. Howard could really write a Robert E. Howard story. I get some inspiration for some. I was really delighted to work on those two novels that were inspired by The Thing on the Roof. There are a couple of others I'd like to write. I'd like for another change of pace. I'd like to write a pirate story based on. It's not. He didn't. Howard didn't write any stories about this character. He just made a casual passing reference to him in Black Volmayo's Vengeance, a Dutch pirate called Van Raven. He's being questioned about the man's whereabouts, which he doesn't know. He just says, "Van Raven, he's a bird of passage. Who knows where he sails?" It was interesting. I thought, yeah, I'd like to write a novel about Van Raven, maybe out in the Dutch East Indies, because no surprise, I love pirate stories too.
Yeah, of course. Me too. You mentioned working on with Andy Offutt on the
Oh, yes.
Cormac McGarth. Did you guys keep in contact after that?
Not really. I mean, we wrote a bit, but no, after we did the two novels, we Didn't and after a couple of my stories got published in his Swords Against Darkness series of collections, no, we sort of didn't get in touch with each other after that. I never got to go to the USA either.
So you've never been to the USA?
No, I haven't. I'm getting a bit older now, so I'll see if I make it. But
Yeah, never say never.
I am planning, if I can, to live to be 97. And since I'm grotesquely healthy right now, I might make it.
I think you will.
And I hope I'll still be writing.
Me too. I'm a big, like I said, I'm a big fan, Keith.
Thank you.
We've been talking about Robert Howard, but what are you some of your favorite Lovecraft stories?
Oh, let's see. Well, there are the I really like the ones he did in imitation of Lord Dunsany, but the ones he did in his own voice. There are the ones he did about the thing on the doorstep, not to be confused with the thing on the roof. That was chilling.
I love the Carter series. I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Randolph Carter Dream Quest of
Randolph
Unknown.
Carter, yeah, I
Yeah.
like that too. Yeah, Through the Gates of the Silver Key and those other ones. Yeah,
Yeah. Love them.
that's one of the ones I was trying to think of.
Oh,
Yeah,
okay.
and at the end of the story, when you find out, or one of the stories, when you find out Randolph Carter has been transfigured into something inhuman.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Similar to
happened
Howard.
to a lot of them.
Yeah, similar to Howard pastiches, I feel the same way about Lovecraft pastiches. There's, you can't do dark and moody like Lovecraft. He just has a rhythm.
No,
He has
no.
like a rhythmic beat to the story, the prose almost, and it just gets
Yeah,
more
yeah.
dreary and dreadful as it
Yeah,
goes.
and it was some of yeah, and it was actually Lovecraft's flaws that gave their stories some of their power.
Yeah, exactly. He always picked at himself in the stories too,
Yeah,
about
yeah.
doing the same thing over and over again, but it's your
Yeah.
thing. If it's your thing, you can do it.
Yeah, the case of Charles Dexter Ward is I think that's great.
That's another great one.
Yeah, and it's got and it's subtle. It's got several layers. It's complex, and I like the I like the human his ancestor Joseph Kerwin.
Yeah, that is a great story.
Well, like is the wrong word. He's a great villain, though.
That's also one of, I think, one of the best movie Lovecraft adaptations, the Roger Corman.
Oh yeah, he called it Edgar Allan Poe's Haunted Palace,
Yeah,
didn't he?
that's what it was called. I couldn't think of the
Yeah,
name that he changed it
yeah,
to, but I
yeah,
thought that was a good adaptation.
yeah. No, it was. It was a good adaptation of the Lovecraft story, but I always thought, well, what do you mean, Edgar Allan Poe's Haunted Palace? This isn't based on Poe. Yeah, but I love the movie.
Yeah, and
I like most Vincent Price movies.
me too. I think my personal favorite, I like all of most of Lovecraft stuff, but I think my personal favorite is Beyond the Walls of Sleep.
Oh, yeah.
That's a
I haven't
good
read
one.
that in a long time.
That's a really good one. I like, he kind of lets you into, it's sort of an idea on the afterlife that I kind of like, with Al Gold, the Daemon Star, and how
Oh, yeah.
the guy's gonna die and attack the Demon Star, and he sees the shooting star after the guy dies. I like that.
Beyond the Walls of Sleep. I've got to reread that.
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding me. Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
I've been reading I've been reading a lot of Lovecraft as well as Howard to get into the mood for the novels I'm writing now. The ones that are inspired by the thing on the roof. Yeah.
Good mood setters.
Oh, they are. Yeah.
Keith, what would you say is the best writing advice that you've been given, and who gave it to you?
Oh, I forget who said it, but I wait a minute. Actually, I think it was Robert Heinlein. It might have been, or I might be wrong, but anyway, he just said, "There's only just three rules. You've got to write, you've got to finish what you write, and then you've got to send it out and keep sending it out.
Like that.
Don't stop and don't get discouraged. Keep sending it out till it finds a publisher."
Usually, and eventually you will. Another question I like to ask everyone is, have you ever had an experience that you would consider supernatural, paranormal, or an event you can't explain?
I hate to say it, but no. I would like to be able to say yes and give it to you in harrowing detail, but I've never encountered anything that as an adult that scared and disturbed me, like that cat on the windowsill when I was a little kid.
Do you consider yourself religious, or are you spiritual, or anything along those lines?
No, not really. I mean, I'm not even sure there's any kind of afterlife, although I think it's possible. But I am not really a fan of hardline organized religion at all.
Yeah, don't blame you. Not much, not much, not a lot of good. I'll say not a lot of good has come out of it, but some good has come out of it. Mostly the art.
But we did get we did get the Crusades and the Inquisition, which are great material for horror stories.
Exactly, you know, that's a
Yeah.
positive.
Yeah. Now that it's all safely in the past.
Yes,
Yeah.
maybe not in the past for much longer.
It's a it's a worrying thought.
Keith, I know you got some irons in the fire, so just to put a bow on this thing here, what's everything you're working on, and do you have a timeline? You know, what's on the horizon for you?
Oh yeah, what's on the rise? Well, when I finish the novel I'm working on at the moment about the it's another one that's inspired by The Thing on the Roof, a sequel to the first one. But when I finish that, what I would really like to do is get back to the detective novel set in Ireland. I was working; it's two thirds done. But then I got the acceptance, the contract for Damned from Birth, which is what the novel is called, based on Thing on the Roof. I got not only a contract for that, but a contract for a sequel. So I thought, oh, this is great! And so I dropped the detective novel set in Ireland, and I'm working on this. I'm about halfway through it now, the second one. And when I finish it, I'd like to get back and try finishing the detective novel.
Okay. You got you're like writing a lot.
I really feel enthusiastic now, and I want to get as much written as possible.
Please do. What
Because
is Bard Six coming as
none of
well?
us are going to be around forever.
Are you expecting Bard Six to be out this year?
Yes, I'm hoping. That's the plan. As I said, I didn't want to just start doing an endless series of Felimbed novels and churning them out, but I really wanted to tie up the loose ends after he'd returned to Ireland and settled down again. Or partly settled down. Now that that's done, I'd really like to try different things,
Yeah.
something fresh.
Have you considered potentially other characters in Felimed's universe and kind of going
Oh
maybe that
yeah, I have. The I thought about writing about two of the characters who were in Gudrun's pirate crew and who survived the big gory finish on the island of Sark.
Mm.
That's a, that, that's in the Channel Islands, and it's pretty much the way I described it. There are two characters from that, two of Gudrun's pirates, two of her chief henchmen. One was a Spaniard named Decius. The other was his very good buddy, a Goth named Adolf. They both came from Spain originally. Actually, they met when they were they'd been kidnapped and made slaves on board a Vandal galley. They never liked the Vandals after
I
that.
wouldn't either. Well, Keith, man, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, man. Like I said, I'm a big fan. Looking forward to what you've got coming in the future.
Oh, it's been a privilege. It's been great. Great. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. You have a great rest of
I
your
will
day.
look forward to that. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks a lot.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Keith. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next time.
Monsters, madness, and magic.
'Welcome to the night. You think you know Night Demon? Then the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast is for you. Step into the darkness as we peel back the curtain to give you an unprecedented, all-access look into the mind and the heart of the demon. We're talking band history, song analysis, studio anecdotes, stories from the road. It's everything a diehard Night Demon fan could want and more. This is the only place to learn the inside scoop, the deep dive trivia, the untold tales from the band members themselves and those closest to the Night Demon story. Need more? The sacred Night Demon crypt will be pried open to reveal demo recordings that have never before seen the light of day, all with in-depth commentary by the band and the people who were there for the writing and recording process. This is a gold mine, a treasure trove of all things Night Demon. Head over to nightdemon.net or wherever you listen to podcasts.